afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon every day, Monday through Friday, and that would be today as well. If you are listening to the live broadcast during the afternoon, you may participate in it. Some of you listen to a later broadcast at night, rebroadcast it. That's not a live program. That's just being played by tape delay. But if you're listening in the afternoon, you're listening to the actual program as it's taking place, and you can be part of it by calling 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Our first caller today is William, calling from Marina, California. William, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. My question today is found in Isaiah. And hang on.
We got a lot of electrical noise coming from your end.
Is that bothering you?
Not too bad. No, go ahead.
Okay. It says here, hang on. In Isaiah, verse 54.
Which chapter?
Isaiah, let me see. Chapter 54, verse 16. See, it is I who created the blacksmith, who fans the coals into flames, and forges the weapons for it works. And it is I who have created the destroyer to work havoc. That's God?
Yes, God is speaking.
Okay, can you explain that verse to me, please?
Yeah, God is saying that he's the one who's the creator of everyone, including our enemies, including those who forge enemies, who forge weapons against us, and so forth. He says in verse 17, no weapon formed against you shall prosper. And he can only make that promise because he is the one who sovereignly is the creator and controller of all people, including the enemies and the weapons. So he's simply saying, that he's the one who created not only the weapons, but he created the people who made the weapons. And therefore, if he wishes, he can protect us from those weapons. He is in charge and he's in control of all those of all of those problems going back several steps. I mean, if we're under attack, someone is bringing their weapons against us. Well, God has, God's greater than those weapons. In fact, he's even greater than the people who made the weapons, because he made them. And I think that's what he's saying there.
Okay, so I had a discussion with a brother, and I told him that God created everything, right? Even the evil that's in this world. Am I wrong in saying that? Because nothing's created that hasn't been created by him, right?
Well, evil is not a created thing.
It's not?
No, evil is a quality. Evil is a moral quality of certain actions. In other words, if I murder you, that action is an evil action. Did God create the evil? Well, no, it's not. It's not. Evil is not a thing to be created. It is a description of a certain action. I created the action. It happens to be an evil action, so I guess I'm responsible for that evil. But to say that God created evil, we'd have to say, well, in what sense is evil a created thing? Evil is not a thing. Evil is a quality of certain actions. If you do an action that is evil, then you are responsible and have created that evil action. But evil itself is simply a description of certain kinds of actions. It's not something in itself.
What I was trying to explain to this guy is that I mean, I understand. Okay, that God had to create, in order for us to have free will, the whole playing field, as per se, right? A playing field. They're his rules, and we have to either we follow his rules the way he said, the narrow road, or choose the wide road to destruction by doing what he says we're not supposed to do. That's basically what I'm saying. That God had to create that environment for us to choose, right? Because if it was just all good, then we wouldn't have any choice, right? You understand what I'm getting at?
Well, God created a free species. human beings who are free to obey him or not. He gave directions to them. Now, if those people obey his directions, then they're doing good. If they disobey his directions, they're doing evil. Okay? Now, God didn't create the evil that they did. He didn't create the good they did either. He just created people who can choose. And then he gave them directions. He gave them commands. Now, obeying those commands is good. Disobeying those commands is evil. But obedience is not a thing, and disobedience are not a thing. They are actions. And goodness is not a thing, and evil is not a thing. Goodness describes certain actions that are good actions, and evil describes certain actions that are evil actions. So, yes, God did create a world with options. That is, he created people who had the power of choosing between options, the option of obedience or disobedience. I think that'd be safe to say.
So if when he created Lucifer, the bright morning star, the perfect angel, he, in essence, didn't he create the, he knew exactly what he was going to do, right?
Well, I believe that God knows everything that everyone's going to do. Yeah.
So in essence, he created the scenario, right? I mean, doesn't it say?
Right. God created options, like I said. Now, the devil, I believe, exists in order to provide options. The devil exists as one to provide alternative suggestions to what God has commanded. God has commanded people to do a certain thing. The devil is there to test them. That's what the word tempt means. The word tempt means test. And so it's like students in school taking a test. There's a right answer and there's a wrong answer, or perhaps many different possible wrong answers. But the point is, the examiner is there to present the student with, let's say, multiple choices to see if the student chooses the right answer. Now, there are wrong answers on the multiple choice paper. And those wrong answers have been provided by the examiner, by the tester. It doesn't mean that the examiner wants the student to choose the wrong answers necessarily, although the devil might have that as his desire. But God's desire in making, creating the devil was not that he wanted people to make the wrong choices. He wanted them to make the right choices, but he wanted them to make the right choices with other options available to choose from. And so the devil is there to present the other options, to present the testing, the temptation, as he did to Eve. God told Eve and Adam, don't eat of that fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The devil basically indicated that they could do so and that it would be to their benefit to do so. So now they're being tested. There's a right answer and a wrong answer. They chose the wrong answer and they failed the test. They could have chosen the right answer and not failed it. So the devil is there as the tester. He's called the tempter in the Bible, and the word tempter means tester.
Oh, okay. So, I don't know. It just seems like God, I mean, I know he's in control, right? Just like I said, it's his playing field, and we got to play by his rules. And that's okay by me. You know, if he created, you know, certain things that people, God can't be, you know, he couldn't create bad. He couldn't, but everything comes from him. Where would it come from? It didn't come from him, right? Everything that's been created has been created by him.
Right, but you're still speaking of things. You're still thinking about things that are created. And when we're talking about evil, we're talking about things that are done, not created. I mean, let's consider evil for a moment. Where do you find evil? Where would you find it? What are its dimensions? What are, you know, how much does it weigh? What is evil? Well, evil isn't something that has dimensions and you can spot it somewhere as a thing. You recognize evil as a quality of certain behavior. There's evil behavior. It's like talking about slow. You know, some people work slowly. The work they do is slow. Well, is slow a created thing? No, it's just a description of a certain kind of actions. And evil actions describe a certain kind of actions. Actions that are disobedient to God are evil actions. No one has to create evil. No one has to create slow. No one has to create, you know, anything that is simply descriptive of action. The actions are either evil or they're not evil. And people are the ones who determine their own actions in terms of whether they're going to do the right or the wrong thing. And so evil actions were first introduced by people. God didn't do any evil actions. And so evil didn't exist until someone did something wrong.
Okay. I guess I think I understand. Do you have time for another question?
Well, my lines are full, but we can maybe take one more if it doesn't take too long.
Okay. This has nothing to do. My question is this. I'm going to give you a scenario that if a father gives his daughter his word that if she tells him something, that he will not tell her mother about it, and it's something that he feels that her mother should know, you know, in the long run, it's going to benefit her, you know. And do you think that a father should keep his word to his daughter?
I think a man should keep his word. I think he needs to be careful what he gives his word about. Lots of people promise other people that they will tell no one the information that they've been told. And that is a dangerous thing to do, because you never know when, in fact, the information may need to come out, who knows, as testimony in court or something else. You never really know for sure what information you may be called upon to, for the benefit of everybody concerned, to share. It's really particularly awkward when somebody tells you a secret, and then after they tell you a secret, they say, now don't tell anyone this. You know, and it's like suddenly you already know the information, and you have not committed yourself to not telling anyone. You're just being ordered not to tell anyone. I think in a case where someone is trying to entrust you with a secret, and they say, don't tell anyone about this, you should say, well, I'm going to be judicious with your secret. I will not tell anybody that I don't feel absolutely needs to know, and I hope never to have to tell anybody at all. But you'll have to, if you're going to tell me your secret, you're going to have to trust my character and trust my judgment that I will not tell anyone unless I feel it's absolutely necessary.
Okay, so if you give your word and you feel it's absolutely necessary, then God, you're not really, it's not, God doesn't frown upon you, like you're actually, you know, like lying to the person or something like that?
Well, it is breaking a promise, and I don't think Christians should break promises. I think probably what a person should do is go back to the daughter in that case and say, listen, for these reasons, I feel it necessary to let your mother know such and such. Now, I'm asking you to give me permission to tell that secret, because I did tell you I wouldn't tell anyone, and I don't want to lie to you. But I feel compelled to tell your mother, and I'm going to have to ask you to release me from that promise that I was sworn to secrecy about. Now, hopefully you can persuade her, but I wouldn't probably tell something if I promised somebody I wouldn't. But what people need to become more careful about is not, they should not be making promises that they won't tell anyone anything. The Bible says in the Proverbs, a faithful man keeps secrets. Well, if you're a faithful person, people can trust you with their secrets. However, that doesn't mean that a secret should never be told to anybody under any circumstances. If somebody said to you, listen, I'm going to tell you something, but you have to promise never to tell anyone, and they'd say, okay, I won't tell. And the next thing they say is, I just shot my husband. Well, what are you going to do? You know, how can you not tell? How can you not call the police? How can you not tell anyone those things? What if you're brought on the witness stand? I mean, it's just crazy to give a blanket promise that you will never tell anyone something. I realize we do it all the time. It's one way of getting people to confide in us. But I think we need to take the risk that maybe they won't confide in us, but we would have to tell them, you know, I will keep your secret the best I feel like I can. I will not tell anybody unless I feel it's absolutely essential for them to know. But if you don't trust me with that judgment call, then you'd better keep your secrets to yourself, because there may be times when I would feel obligated to tell somebody something. Okay. Now, if you've already made the promise, I think you should go back to the daughter and try to get her to release you from it. And tell her why. Tell her why it's important for her mother to know. Tell her why it's unfair to keep the information from the mother or whatever. But I really don't think you should make promises to a person and then break them.
Well, it was specifically for that reason that you mentioned was, the confidential thing. That's why, this person doesn't trust people because she's been, they've done that in the past. But
see, what if you made that promise that you won't tell, and then you go tell the mother? Then the daughter will never trust people anymore at all because you promised you'd keep it a secret and then you didn't.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right about, going back and asking for permission. That's a good idea.
Yeah, ask to be released from that. That's what Proverbs suggests that should be done if you've made a foolish, promise.
Okay, Steve, I want to thank you for your patience and time, and God bless you, and let me have more callers.
Okay, William, God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Good talking to you. Bye now. Our next caller is Ben calling from Vancouver, Washington. Ben, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Well, hi, Steve. Thanks. The other night I had a long conversation with a very good friend of mine. We go pretty far back. And he's an unbeliever. And we were talking about church. And he mentioned that churches are just business enterprises trying to make money. And I guess I was kind of stuck because a lot of what he's saying is true.
Yeah, what was his source of information about that? Had he been involved in a church and found it to be so? Had he been in the leadership of a church and found that it was run like a business? Or, I mean, where was he getting that information?
I guess he's getting it from the media because he's an unbeliever.
Yeah.
And,
well, the media
kind of anti-church, I guess.
Right. Well, what I would say is I'm sure that is true of many churches. I'm sure there are many religious organizations that have been formed by people who are not Christians, but they want to bilk Christians of their money, so they get a 501c3, start a religious radio or television program or a church of some kind or another kind of Christian nonprofit, and they raise funds, and then they, that's all they're interested in doing is getting money. Now, I would say the majority of churches wouldn't fit that description, though it is true that churches these days do operate a lot like businesses. But that doesn't mean that they've started up in order to have a business-making proposition. Obviously, a church, if it's going to own a building, if it's going to have salaried clergy and things like that, they're going to have income. They're going to have some money coming in, and there's a good chance they're going to be trying to raise money from the congregation or other places. Now, I'm not in favor of that necessarily. I don't believe the early church had salaried professional ministers. And I don't believe that they had buildings. But if an organization chooses to have a church that's run like that, well, of course, they're going to have to make some money to pay the salaries and pay for the buildings and things like that. That does not mean that the church that is trying to make money in order to pay their bills is operating only for the purpose of raising money. And it certainly doesn't mean that they started up with the intention of getting rich. Most people, if they want to get rich, would do something other than start a church. There's better ways to guarantee getting rich than that, although some churches do get rich. It's not something that I think most of the churches I know started with that in mind. It seems to me that most of the churches I have any inside knowledge about are started by people who really wanted to preach the gospel, who really wanted to serve God in some way or another. Now, there may have been mixed motives in some cases, because a lot of times the church is started by a guy who has just gotten out of Bible college and he's looking for a job in the ministry, and planting a church is a way to get one. And so, in a sense, some people in ministry may have a mixture of motivations. They want to serve God. They want to promote the kingdom of God. They're also looking for some financial security for themselves and their families. I don't personally operate like that because I don't like that mixture of motives. When I went into the ministry, it was 39 years ago, I decided I would never allow money making to be a motive for ministry, and I would never sell or contract to do ministry for a salary or anything like that, because I felt like as soon as the ministry becomes a job, there are many temptations to think of the ministry in the wrong way. That doesn't mean that every minister who gets a salary does think of the ministry the wrong way, but there are temptations to do so. I mean, once the ministry is viewed as the source of your income, well, then, of course, when times get tight, you start wondering about, you know, your job security and the ministry and things like that. I've always felt that it's a more secure thing for a person in ministry, like myself, to not depend on any organization to pay a paycheck. I've never received a paycheck from any Christian organization. I've never worked for a Christian organization for pay, and I don't charge for what I do because I feel that it's so much more secure to be an employee of God. That is, just work for God and let God pay your bills however he may choose. And that way you never have to worry about your job security, because as long as you're pleasing God and doing his work, he's not going to fire you. On the other hand, you do have to fear God, and you have to keep your nose clean, because if you don't, he might fire you, you know. But you don't at least have to worry about an organization getting upset with you because you did something you felt God wanted you to do. So I think ministries really would find it easier to avoid the profit motive by simply serving God and not worrying about the money, not taking salaries and things like that. But that's just me. I mean, it might not just be me, but it is me, and other people think differently. But I think it's unfair to, of course, your friend's a non-Christian, and we can't expect them to think fairly about Christianity, since he probably doesn't see much except what's on TV, and that is a lot of hokey stuff, you know, and a lot of it is money-making garbage. So, I mean, non-Christians will not necessarily have a fair assessment of the motives of churches, because especially if the non-Christians don't go to a church. They don't know the people who run the church. They don't know what the church is doing. They just assume that churches are like those people on TV, on the Christian TV stations. And, of course, if that's the only picture of Christians you get, you've got every reason to be suspicious.
Well, Steve, I guess I was kind of taken aback because of my personal experience with the church.
Uh-huh.
I was going to a church that was not preaching the Lordship of Christ, nor talking about repentance very much, and it seemed like they were only interested in having a big church. So I can see that church was more like a business enterprise.
Could well be. I mean, you know, I sometimes attend a big church. I'm not a member of any church, but I attend different churches. But there's a pretty big church in my area that I attend from time to time, and you know, I would say it's a seeker-sensitive church, and I've pretty much been critical of seeker-sensitive philosophy for the most part. But this church, you know, they're big, but the pastor, in my opinion, uses the Bible in a good way. There may be some subjects he wouldn't feel comfortable preaching on that I would. I don't know. I haven't talked to him about it, but for the most part, when I hear him preach, I think I don't go there thinking, boy, he's watering things down. And I've been pleased with that. I think that pastor is a very good man. I respect him. But I do think that a lot of the big churches do have the motive you're talking about, but I couldn't really tell you which ones because I don't know their pastors. It's awfully risky to judge the motives of a pastor that you don't know personally. Now, of course, you can, if a guy's on TV or on the radio or you go to that church a long time and the things the guy says make it very clear that he's just all about the money or something like that, then I feel like you're justified in making some kind of a judgment then. And you may have found that to be true in the church you were attending. I'm sure there are plenty of churches that fit that criticism, that they, you know, they just want to get their church big for various reasons. I had a friend who left the ministry. That is, he didn't leave the Lord, but he left the ministry of the pastoral ministry of a church because he said his denomination, which I won't reveal which denomination it was, but it was a good, it was at least an evangelical denomination that I'd always thought well of, as denominations go. He said his denomination, in their pastors' conferences, all they were about is the three B's, the bodies, the bricks, and the bucks. That is, get more bodies into your church, get more bricks, you know, build the buildings bigger, and get more money. And that is the way that some churches are motivated. That's the measure of success in some cases in professional ministry, and it shouldn't be. It should not be, and when it is, it's definitely a bad testimony, and I think that your friend maybe has seen cases where that where that perhaps was true, or maybe he's making an unfair judgment based on a limited sample.
Well, yeah, Steve, well, thanks a lot, but, you know, I'm thinking that what you are doing is not the usual.
Well, no, that's true. I mean, not everyone has a radio show, but if I were the pastor of a church, God forbid, because I would not wish to be a pastor of a church, but if I were the pastor of a church, I would live by faith as I do now. I would refuse to take a salary. I would serve God in any capacity that anyone, you know, serves God, if I had the gifts for it and it was what God was leading me to do. But even if it was a position that where other men do feel like they need to take salaries, it's always been my conviction that I would not do so.
Okay. Well, thanks, Steve. Thanks for your insight.
Okay, Ben. God bless you.
You too.
Bye now. And by the way, I want to make this clear. In saying that I wouldn't take a salary, I don't want to give the impression that this is a way of saying I'm a better person than people who do take salaries. I'd rather say it's because I'm probably not good enough a person. If I had a salary, I think I'd be spiritually weak enough to begin to look to that paycheck as my provision. Just like if I worked at any job, I would tend to look at the paycheck as my provision. I'm not saying that people who have jobs can't overcome that temptation. For me, I think it'd be more difficult. So, in a sense, the reason I don't take any salary from any source and have no predictable income from any source is not because I'm a better person, but because I think I'm probably a bit weaker than some people maybe are. And I would not like what it would do to me spiritually to have a paycheck for the ministry. I do like to go to the mailbox and find money for me there, because that's how my bills are paid. But at least I don't know what's coming there or when, and I just know that God, you know, God just brings it in when it should come in. And that's that way I see God as the supplier. And then I can keep my focus where I think I want it. I mean, I know I want it, is to be, I want to be serving God, not an organization, not someone who pays me a check. So that's just... That's me, and I'm not saying that I'm better than other people. I do it, of course, not only because of what I just described, that is my own weakness, that if I had a paycheck coming in, I would tend to look to it somewhat as my supply rather than maybe God. But the other reason I do it is because of my convictions. I personally believe that when Jesus said, freely you've received, freely give, that means something. Whatever I have to give you, I got for free. I mean, God... I've paid nothing. I paid nothing in the way of education. I paid some money for some books I've read, but I would have been, I don't know, I would have read those anyway, even if I wasn't in the ministry. I was interested. But I've had no education. I've just been immersed in the Word of God since childhood. And that's my choice and probably my calling. But the point is, it didn't cost me anything. Whatever gifts I have in the way of teaching or whatever, which I'm sure many listeners would dispute that I have them, but okay, it looks like we've got our power back on here. I don't know if I'm coming across on the air or not. I need some information from my station about that. Okay, great. I just got the information. For those of you who may wonder, as I wondered, what happened, the power at the radio station, KKMC, went off. It cut out the internet systems, the phone systems, and, you know, everything else related to putting this show on the air. So, anyway, we're going to try to get back going again. I don't know if we have any calls waiting because my computer connection to the studio went down. Not because of my computer problems, but because the computer at the station went down and we lost our connection. So I don't really know if we have callers waiting yet. We're going to have to find out. Let me give you the number just in case. If you'd like to be on the air, the number is 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090 if you'd like to be on the air with us. I guess I'm being heard again. I can't know until I'm talking to somebody, I guess, if you're really hearing me. But I'm assuming you are. So let me give it to you again. 1-800-438-5090. Give me a call. We'll be talking, and we can take your questions. We still have a reasonable portion of the show left. So we haven't lost all of our opportunities here. I notice now I've got my got my call screening software up, that the lines are filled up. We're going to talk to Nick from Tonawanda, New York. Nick, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks again. Hey, I actually called yesterday. Calling again today because
I remember.
Appreciated your answer yesterday. But anyways, I had another question about resurrection. And there's a verse. Well, actually, I know you've dealt with Revelation a lot, the book of Revelation. There's a verse in Revelation chapter 20, verse 5, and it talks about there's a first resurrection, and then after this millennial time period or this long period, then there's the final resurrection. And I'm wondering if that has any connections with, in Matthew 27, verse 52, I think, where it talks about, a bunch of men, bodies rising from the dead.
It's a good guess, but I don't think the two are related. And the reason I don't is because that would suggest that those few people that were raised from the dead in Matthew 27, when Jesus rose from the dead, who are not even identified, we're just told they were saints who had died, came out, and they were seen in Jerusalem. To say that they are the first resurrection, meaning, you know, what we see in Revelation 20 for the 1,000 years, they're not that significant. Only one passage in the Bible even mentions them and doesn't tell us who they are. I really don't think that's the first resurrection. In my opinion, the first resurrection is the experience of being born again, that we pass from death unto life when we become believers. That is our first resurrection. It is a spiritual resurrection, a passing from death unto life. And then at the end of the age, when Jesus comes back, we will experience a physical resurrection. So there's a spiritual resurrection, which is the first resurrection, and there's a physical resurrection, which is our second resurrection. Now, this is in contrast to the premillennial view. The premillennial view thinks that the first resurrection is a physical resurrection of the Christians, and the second resurrection is a physical resurrection of the non-Christians. So they would believe that both resurrections are physical resurrections of two different groups of people. But I believe that that's not how John has it in mind. In John chapter 5, verses 28 and 29, John records Jesus as saying that the hour is coming when all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth, those who've done good to a resurrection of life and those who've done evil to a resurrection of condemnation. So Jesus says, and John records this, Jesus says that an hour is coming where all the dead, good and bad, are going to be raised from the graves. So there's not two physical resurrections at different times. There's only one physical resurrection at one time, which includes the good and the bad, according to Jesus. So what is the first resurrection that precedes the second resurrection? Well, that's two different resurrections that the same people have. It's not two different groups of people having a physical resurrection each. It's rather two resurrections that Christians have. We have, when we become Christians, a spiritual resurrection where we were dead in trespasses and sins and he's made us alive spiritually. And then when we have died and Jesus comes back, then we have a second resurrection, which is our physical resurrection. That's what I think Revelation is talking about in those references.
Okay. And you know, okay, that's interesting. I see inconsistency between the connection, the two passages where I could see both why people would connect it and why people won't. But the reason why I made a connection and almost started to think it might be the same thing was because within the context of the Revelation passage, it seems to insinuate that, well, when it says that it makes a distinction between the bodily and it basically says that these ones will not have tasted the second death. And it makes a distinction between the first and the second death, which made me think, wait a minute, maybe there was a first resurrection because do you know what I'm saying? I'd have to find it.
Well, okay, it seems to me that the first and second death refer to physical death, the first one. And the second death is the lake of fire. We're told that at the end of the chapter, that the second death is the lake of fire. So there's two deaths. One is natural death, and one is not natural death. It's another kind of death. And so there are two resurrections. One is a natural resurrection, that is a physical resurrection of the body that has experienced natural death. The other is a spiritual resurrection. So I think that the two resurrections and the two deaths are of different, the two resurrections are different in kind from each other, and the two deaths are different in kind from each other.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then I would you say that I'm reading chapter 20, verse 6 wrong, where it seems to me that it's insinuating when it says, blessed and holy is the one who has a part in the first resurrection, over these the second death has no power, insinuating that the first death, which would be a natural death, would be what people who had resurrected from that death had undertaken, talking about those in Revelation 20. Do you see why, in my mind, it seems to insinuate that when I read it, or?
Well, I actually don't. I think you make it too difficult to say
okay.
That those who have received the first resurrection are those of us who've been born again. Okay. Now, on them, the second death, which is the lake of fire, will have no claim, will have no power over us. So, in other words, if you've been born again, you will not be thrown in the lake of fire. That's what that's saying.
Okay. All right. I'll just have to look at it.
That's another way of saying if you're saved, you don't go to hell.
Yeah, no doubt. Exactly.
It's not really. I wouldn't make it more difficult than that.
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay, Nick.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for your call. Now we'll talk to Steve from Beaverton, Oregon. Next, Steve. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for talking to me. And first to say. I've gotten to talk to you a couple times before, and I really appreciate what you do. I appreciate you studying things the way you study them, and I'm always telling my wife and telling my friends some of the things that you say and encourage them to listen. I kind of wanted to say a little bit. I didn't get to hear everything because I was working. But uh-huh. One of the things they were talking about, someone looking at church seeming a little bit like business.
Yeah.
And one thing I have to say is I went to a church for quite a while, and the pastor, many times would get up and he would say, I know what you're thinking out there. I'm here because I'm paid to be here. And I always thought, well, couldn't something be done about that? Especially a very, very common thing is they have pastors saying, you really need to be in church on Sunday. I know you only have 2 days. You have Saturday and Sunday. You really need to give the one day to God but then to realize that the pastors, generally the ones I've known, have all had Friday and Saturday or Monday and Saturday off, that they said we didn't need to have a full weekend, but that they did. And I always thought, like, I know for you, I'm sure in a teaching situation you love to be teaching. That it seems to me, I've heard you say, you don't really need a day off because, you know, that's food and drink for you. You love doing it. And I had the opportunity to lead worship for about a year and a half, and I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. And
yeah,
so
I always look forward to the weekend ending so I can do my work again.
Well, that's it. And so, to me, I think, you know, any pastors out there, if a pastor could get up on a Sunday and say, you know what, I'm paid to study and prepare Monday through Friday, but you know what, I give God Sunday just like I'm asking you to, because I don't want to be anywhere else. But I've never heard that. And I had one pastor I talked to, I said, well, you know, the pastor knows that people think it's kind of a business and stuff, you know, and he knows that people feel a little funny that he'd be paid on Sunday, you know, and that, you know, all that. And the guy said, well, the reason we're paid on Sunday is because we have to be here and you guys don't. Now, I don't think I'd ever hear that from a pulpit, but I'm just thinking, I know for me when I was doing it, I would rather be there and I wouldn't want anybody to think I was there that day. They'd have to pay me to be there that day. I certainly understand.
Yeah, I think the pastor would be in a much better position, much stronger position in a way, if he told the church board, you know, I don't want to take a salary anymore. I want to trust God that if I'm doing his work, he will provide for me. And I would like the congregation to know that. And, of course, I'd like to put a box in the back so that if anyone in the congregation would like to help contribute to my family's needs, they can put some money in there. But I'm not going to require it. I'm not going to ask for it. And I'm not going to charge for what I do.
Well,
and it'd be amazing. I think he'd find out that his needs were all met if he's doing the Lord's work.
Well, and that to me would be ideal, but I'm not even asking that. Even if the pastor said, look, you know, I'm paid Monday through Friday, but not to be paid on Sunday. There's just something so bad about that
I know, but that's kind of artificial because he's probably paid a salary. He's not paid a wage. It's not likely that he's paid for a 40-hour week. He's paid to be a pastor, and there's a salary attached to it. And being a pastor includes preaching sermons on Sunday. So, I mean, he could say, well, I'm not paid for Sunday. But what's that mean? They're going to reduce his salary by about, you know, one-seventh or something?
No, it's not that. Because what's weird is the ones that I've known have, like, Friday and Saturday off. Like, they require 2 days that they're not.
Ah, I see. I see. Yeah, so
that's all I mean.
So he should only take one day off. Yeah.
He should take Saturday off, and because if he prepared ahead of time and he's there, it's like, I'll tell you the truth. I really love leading worship, and if someone said, "Would you rather sit or you'd rather, you know, help a leading worship?" I'd say, "Well, I'd rather do it. I've had my turn. I don't need to ever turn again." But if I had my choice, if nobody wanted to do it, well, that'd be great. I'd love to do it.
Yeah.
And so I just I don't see Sunday as someone saying, well, I have to be paid here because, you know what, I need to be paid because I have to be here. Pastors could get up and say, I'm paid during the week, but you know what, I only have 2 days off too, just like you guys, and I want to be here. That would be a start, and it's sad to me that I've never, ever run into it. I know that it's out there somewhere, but I just, in all the churches that I've known.
You do have to realize that Sunday is a what we would have to call a work day for a pastor. Especially if he does. His work is preaching the gospel, and so Sunday is when the crowd gathers to hear him do it. So he's got to be there to do it. It's not like he could just stay home and watch TV and say, well, you know, let someone else preach. Well, I mean, that's what he's agreed to do. That's what he's there doing. He's their preacher, and so although I don't consider it work to teach, and a preacher might not consider it work to preach, it is nonetheless a responsibility. You have to show up. I mean, this is something where, you know, I teach a weekly meeting in Santa Cruz, and I teach a weekly meeting in Salinas. Now, I have to be there. I don't mind being there. I like being there. I enjoy it, and I don't get paid for it, but I like being there. But if I wanted to do something else on a Monday night or a Thursday night, I couldn't. I have to be there, whereas everyone else who goes there, they come or go as it's convenient for them. I mean, they come or go if they want to.
Well, I realize that's true. But I know that for the year and a half or 2 years, I led worship as a volunteer for a high school group. I had the freedom to say, I'm here because I want to be here. And I would not, I'd rather be here than anywhere else. And maybe, I don't know, if a pastor can't say that, that seems like a shame. It seems like, especially these days, I've heard so many people.
Well, of course. Of course. Well, let me just say this because the music's playing. But
I'm sorry.
Well, if the pastor said that he has to be there on Sunday, that doesn't mean that he doesn't love to be there too. He may be just trying to say to you, you know, I don't have any choice. I don't have liberty to make different plans for Sunday as some of you do. Some of you people can go out of town for the weekend to the lake and go fishing or boating or visit relatives, or you can go away for a week on vacation, but I've got to be here. And it's not that I don't want to be here. I love to be here. I just want you to understand that I'm here whether it's the thing I'd want to do or not, because this is what I'm called to do, and this is what I've agreed to do. I mean, it doesn't mean that he's doesn't like it. He may be just trying to make it clear to you that Sunday is not really a free day for him, and it is for you. And if you go to church for 1 hour or 2 hours on Sunday, his Sunday involves a lot more than that. He might have to preach two or three services if he's got a big church, and more than that, he probably has other obligations that are related to the church on Sunday too. It's like another day for him. Anyway, I'm almost out of time here. I'm going to be cut off in less than a half minute. God bless you. Thanks for your call, Steve. And you've been listening to The Narrow Path. If you'd like to help us pay our radio bills, the address to write to is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. You can find that address. You can find my schedule of speaking. You can find lots of free resources at our website. It's thenarrowpath.com. That's www.thenarrowpath.com. I'm Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk again tomorrow. God bless.